This is Audible.
Random House Audio presents Fried Green Tomatoes at the Whistle Stop Cafe by Fanny Flagg. Read for you by Lorna Raver. The Weems Weekly, Whistle Stop Alabama's Weekly Bulletin, June 12, 1929. Cafe opens. The Whistle Stop Cafe opened up last week, right next door to me at the post office, and owners Iggy Threadgood and Ruth Jameson said business has been good ever since. Iggy says that for people who know her, not to worry about getting poisoned, she is not cooking. All the cooking is being done by two colored women, Sipsy and Onzel, and the barbecue is being cooked by Big George, who is Onzel's husband. If there is anybody who has not been there yet, Iggy says that the breakfast hours are from 5:30 to 7:30, and you can get eggs, grits, biscuits, bacon, sausage, ham and red-eye gravy, and coffee for 25 cents. For lunch and supper, you can have fried chicken, pork chops and gravy, catfish, chicken and dumplings, or a barbecue plate, and your choice of three vegetables, biscuits or cornbread, and your drink and dessert for 35 cents. She said the vegetables are creamed corn, fried green tomatoes, fried okra, collard or turnip greens, black-eyed peas, candied yams, butter beans or lima beans, and pie for dessert. My other half, Wilbur, and I ate there the other night, and it was so good, he says he might not ever eat at home again. Ha ha, I wish this were true. I spend all my time cooking for the big lug, and still can't keep him filled up. By the way, Iggy says that one of her hens laid an egg with a $10 bill in it. Dot Weems. Rose Terrace Nursing Home, Old Montgomery Highway, Birmingham, Alabama. December 15, 1985. Evelyn Couch had come to Rose Terrace with her husband, Ed, who was visiting his mother, Big Mama, a recent but reluctant arrival. Evelyn had just escaped them both and had gone into the visitors' lounge in the back, where she could enjoy her candy bar in peace and quiet. But the moment she sat down, the old woman beside her began to talk. "Now, you ask me the year somebody got married, who they married, or what the bride's mother wore, and 9 times out of 10, I can tell you. But for the life of me, I can't tell you when it was I got to be so old. It just sort of slipped up on me. The first time I noticed it was June of this year, when I was in the hospital for my gallbladder, which they still have. Or maybe they threw it out by now. Who knows? That heavy-set nurse had just given me another one of those fleet enemas they're so fond of over there, when I noticed what they had on my arm. It was a white band that said, "Mrs. Cleo Threadgood, an 86-year-old woman." Imagine that! When I got back home, I told my friend Mrs. Otis, "I guess the only thing left for us to do is to sit around, get ready to croak." She said she preferred the term "pass over to the other side." Poor thing, I didn't have the heart to tell her that no matter what you call it, we're all gonna croak just the same. It's funny. When you're a child, you think time will never go by, but when you hit about 20, time passes like you're on the fast train to Memphis. I guess life just slips up on everybody. It sure did on me. One day I was a little girl, and the next I was a grown woman with bosoms and hair on my private parts. I missed the whole thing. But then, I never was too smart in school, or otherwise. Mrs. Otis and I are from Whistle Stop, a little town about 10 miles from here, out by the railroad yards. She's lived down the street from me for the past 30 years or so, and after her husband died, her son and daughter-in-law had a fit for her to come and live at the nursing home, and they asked me to come with her. I told them I'd stay with her for a while. She doesn't know it yet, but I'm going back home just as soon as she gets settled in good. It's not too bad out here. The other day we all got Christmas corsages to wear on our coats. Mine had little shiny red Christmas balls on it, and Mrs. Otis had a Santa Claus face on hers. But I was sad to give up my kitty, though. They won't let you have one in here, and I miss her. I've always had a kitty or two my whole life. I gave her to that little girl next door, the one who's been watering my geraniums. I've got me 4 cement pots on the front porch, just full of geraniums. My friend Mrs. Otis is only 78 and real sweet, but she's a nervous kind of person. I had my gallstones in a mason jar by my bed, and she made me hide them, said they made her depressed. Mrs. Otis is just a little bit of something, but as you can see, I'm a big woman, big bones and all. But I never drove a car. I've been stranded most of my life. Always stayed close to home. Always had to wait for somebody to come and carry me to the store or to the doctor or down to the church. Years ago, you used to be able to take a trolley to Birmingham, but they stopped running a long time ago. The only thing I'd do different if I could go back would be to get myself a driver's license. You know, it's funny what you'll miss when you're away from home. Now me, I miss the smell of coffee and bacon frying in the morning. You can't smell anything they've got cooking out here, and you can't get a thing that's fried. Everything here is boiled up with not a piece of salt on it. I wouldn't give you a plugged nickel for anything boiled, would you? The old lady didn't wait for an answer. I used to love my crackers and buttermilk, or my buttermilk and cornbread in the afternoon. I like to smash it all up in my glass and eat it with a spoon. But you can't eat in public like you can at home, can you? And I miss wood. My house is nothing but just a little old railroad shack of a house with a living room, bedroom, and a kitchen. But it's wood, with pine walls inside. Just what I like. I don't like a plaster wall. They seem, oh, I don't know, kind of cold and stark-like. I brought a picture with me that I had at home of a girl in a swing with a castle and pretty blue bubbles in the background to hang in my room. But that nurse here said the girl was naked from the waist up and not appropriate. You know, I've had that picture for 50 years, and I never knew she was naked. If you ask me, I don't think the old men they've got here can see well enough to notice that she's bare-breasted. But this is a Methodist home, so she's in the closet with my gallstones. I'll be glad to get home. Of course, my house is a mess. I haven't been able to sweep for a while. I went out and threw my broom at some old noisy blue jays that were fighting, and wouldn't you know it, my broom stuck up there in the tree. I've got to get someone to get it down for me when I get back. Anyway, the other night, when Mrs. Otis's son took us home from the Christmas tea they had at the church, he drove us over the railroad tracks out by where the cafe used to be, and on up First Street, right past the old Threadgood place. Of course, most of the house is all boarded up and falling down now. But when we came down the street, the headlights hit the windows in such a way that, just for a minute, that house looked to me just like it had so many of those nights some 70 years ago, all lit up and full of fun and noise. I could hear people laughing, and Essie Rue pounding away at the piano in the parlor, "Buffalo Gal, Won't You Come Out Tonight," or "The Big Rock Candy Mountain." And I could almost see Iggy Threadgood sitting in the chinaberry tree, howling like a dog every time Essie Rue tried to sing. She always said that Essie Rue could sing about as well as a cow could dance. I guess driving by that house and me being so homesick made me go back in my mind. I remember it just like it was yesterday. But then, I don't think there's anything about the Threadgood family I don't remember. Good Lord, I should. I lived right next door to them from the day I was born, and I married one of the boys. There were 9 children, and 3 of the girls, Essie Rue and the twins, were more or less my own age, so I was always over there playing and having spend-the-night parties. My own mother died of consumption when I was 4, and when my daddy died up in Nashville, I just stayed on for good. I guess you might say the spend-the-night party never ended. The Weems Weekly, Whistle Stop Alabama's Weekly Bulletin, October 8, 1929. Meteorite hits Whistle Stop residence. Mrs. Biddy Louise Otis, who lives at 401 First Street, reported that on Thursday night a 2-pound meteorite crashed through the roof of her house and just missed hitting her, but did hit the radio she was listening to at the time. She said that she was sitting on the couch because the dog was in the chair and had just turned on Flashman's Yeast Hour when it happened. She said that there is a 4-foot hole in her roof and that her radio is broken in half. Bertha and Harold Vick celebrated their anniversary on the front lawn for all the neighbors to see. And congratulations to Mr. Earl Adcock Sr., an executive for the L&N Railroad, who has just been named Grand Exalted Ruler of the Benevolent and Protective Order of the Elks, Order Number 37, of which my other half is a member. By the way, Iggy said if you want something barbecued, to send it over to the cafe and Big George will do it for you. Chickens for 10 cents and hogs according to your size. Dot Weems. Rose Terrace Nursing Home, Old Montgomery Highway, Birmingham, Alabama, December 15, 1985. 1 hour later, Mrs. Threadgood was still talking. Evelyn Couch had finished 3 Milky Ways and was in the process of unwrapping her second Butterfinger, wondering if the old woman beside her was ever going to shut up. "You know, it's a shame the Threadgood house has fallen into such disrepair. So much happened there, so many babies born. We had so many happy times. It was a great big 2-story white frame house with a big front porch that wrapped all the way around to the side. And all the bedrooms had rose-patterned wallpaper that looked so pretty when the lamps were turned on at night. The railroad tracks ran right across the backyard, and on summer nights that yard would be just full of lightning bugs and the smell of honeysuckle that grew wild right alongside the tracks. Papa had the back planted with fig trees and apple trees, and he had built Mama the most beautiful white lattice grape arbor that was full of wisteria vines. And little pink sweetheart roses grew all over the back of the house. Oh, I wish you could have seen it. Mama and Papa Threadgood raised me just like I was one of their own, and I liked all the Threadgoods, especially Buddy. But I married Cleo, his older brother, the chiropractor, and wouldn't you know it, later on I turned out to have a bad back, so it worked out just fine. So you can see I've been keeping up with Iggy and the Threadgoods all my life. And I'll tell you, it's been better than a picture show. Yes, it has. But then, I was always a tag-along sort of person. Believe it or not, I never did talk much until I hit my 50s, and then I just couldn't stop. One time Cleo said to me, "Ninny," my name is Virginia, but they called me Ninny. He said, "Ninny, all I hear is Iggy said this and Iggy did that." He said, "Don't you have anything better to do than to hang around that cafe all day?" I thought long and hard and said, "No, I don't." Not to downgrade Cleo in any way, but it was the truth. I buried Cleo 31 years ago last February, and I often wonder if I hurt his feelings when I said that. But I don't think so, because after all was said and done, he loved Iggy as much as the rest of us, and always got a good laugh out of some of her doings. She was his baby sister and a real cut-up. She and Ruth owned the Whistle Stop Cafe. Iggy used to do all kinds of crazy harebrained things just to get a laugh. She put poker chips in the collection basket at the Baptist church once. She was a character, all right. But how anybody ever could have thought that she killed that man is beyond me. For the first time, Evelyn stopped eating and glanced over at the rather sweet-looking old lady in the faded blue flower-print dress with the silver-gray finger waves, who didn't miss a beat. Some people thought it started the day she met Ruth, but I think it started that Sunday dinner, April the 1st, 1919, the same year Leona married John Justice. I can tell you it was April the 1st, because Iggy came to the dinner table that day and showed everybody this little white box she had with a human finger inside of it, resting on a piece of cotton. She claimed she'd found it out in the backyard. But it turned out to be her own finger she had poked through a hole in the bottom of the box. April Fool! Everybody thought it was funny except Leona. She was the oldest and prettiest sister, and Papa Threadgood spoiled her rotten. Everybody did, I guess. Iggy was about 10 or 11 at the time, and she had on a brand new white organdy dress that we'd all told her how pretty she looked in. We were having a fine time and starting in on our blueberry cobbler, when all of a sudden, out of a clear blue sky, Iggy stood up and announced, just as loud, "I'm never gonna wear another dress as long as I live." And with that, honey, she marched upstairs and put on a pair of Buddy's old pants and a shirt. To this day, I don't have any idea what set her off. None of us had. But Leona, who knew Iggy never said a thing she didn't mean, began to wail. She said, "Oh, Papa, Iggy's going to ruin my wedding. I just know it." But Papa said, "Now, baby girl, that's just not so. You're gonna be the most beautiful bride in the entire state of Alabama." Papa had this great big handlebar mustache. Then he looked at us and he said, "Isn't that right, children?" And we all put in our 2 cents worth to make her feel better and to get her to shut up. All of us except Buddy, that is, who just sat there and giggled. Iggy was his pet, so anything she did was all right with him. So anyway, Leona was finishing her cobbler, and just when we thought she was all calmed down, she screamed so loud that Sipsy, the colored woman, dropped something in the kitchen. "Oh, Papa," Leona said, "what's gonna happen if one of us dies?" Well, it was a thought, wasn't it? We all looked at Mama, who just put her fork down on the table. "Now, children, I'm sure your sister will make that one small concession and wear a proper dress if and when that time ever comes. After all, she's stubborn, but she's not unreasonable." Then, a couple of weeks later, I heard Mama tell Ida Sims, the seamstress for the wedding, that she was gonna need a green velvet suit with a bow tie for Iggy. Ida looked up at Mama kind of funny and said, "A suit?" And Mama said, "Oh, I know, Ida, I know. I tried my best to get her to wear something a little more wedding-like, but that child has a mind of her own." And she did, even at that age. I think she wanted to be like Buddy myself. Oh, those two were a mess. The old lady laughed. One time, they had this raccoon named Cookie, and I used to spend hours watching him try to wash a cracker. They'd put a little pan of water out in the backyard, and then they'd give him a soda cracker. And he'd wash cracker after cracker and never could figure out what happened to it when it would disappear. Each time he'd look at his little empty hands and be so surprised. Never did figure out where his cracker was going. He spent a good part of his life washing crackers. He'd wash cookies, too, but that wasn't as funny. He washed an ice cream cone once. Oh, I better quit thinking about that raccoon, or they're gonna think I'm as crazy as Mrs. Philbeam down the hall. Bless her heart, she thinks she's on the love boat headed for Alaska. A lot of these poor souls out here don't even know who they are. Evelyn's husband, Ed, came to the door of the lounge and motioned. Evelyn wadded up her candy wrappers and put them in her purse and got up. "Excuse me, that was my husband. I think he's ready to go." Mrs. Threadgood looked up surprised, and she said, "Oh, do you have to?" Evelyn said, "Yes, I think I better. He's ready to leave." "Well, I've enjoyed talking to you. What's your name, honey?" "Evelyn." "Well, you come back and see me, you hear? I've enjoyed talking to you." "Bye-bye," she called after Evelyn and waited for another visitor. The Weems Weekly, Whistle Stop Alabama's Weekly Bulletin, October 15, 1929. Ownership of meteorite questioned. Mrs. Vesta Adcock and her son Earl Jr. have claimed that they are the rightful owners of the meteorite because she said that the Otises rented the house that the meteorite hit from her. And so it is her house and her meteorite. Mrs. Biddy Louise Otis was questioned on the matter, and it is her contention that the meteorite is hers because it was her radio that it hit. Her husband Roy, who is a brakeman for the Southern Railroad, was working the late shift and was not home at the time, but said it was not unusual because in 1833, 10,000 meteors fell in one night, and that this was just one and nothing to make a fuss about. Biddy said she thought she'd keep it as a souvenir anyhow. By the way, is it just my imagination, or are times getting harder these days? My other half says that 5 new hobos showed up at the cafe last week looking for something to eat. Dot Weems. Davenport, Iowa. Hobo Camp. October 15, 1929. 5 men sat huddled around a low-burning fire, orange and black shadows dancing on their faces as they drank weak coffee out of tin cans. Jim Smokey Phillips, Elmo Inky Williams, Bo Weevil Jake, Crackshot Sackett, and Chattanooga Red Barker, 5 of the estimated 200,000 men and boys roaming the countryside that year. Smokey Phillips looked up but said nothing, and the rest of them said the same. They were tired and weary that night, because that cold nip in the night air meant the start of another raw, heartless winter, and Smokey knew he would have to be starting south soon, with the great flocks of geese, just as he had done for so many years now. He was born on a frosty morning back up in the Smoky Mountains of Tennessee. His daddy, a knobby-legged man, a second-generation moonshiner who had fallen in love with his own product, made the fatal mistake of marrying a good woman, a plain country girl whose life revolved around the Pine Grove Free Will Baptist Church. Most of Smokey's childhood had been spent sitting on hard wooden benches for hours with his little sister Bernice at all-day singings and foot washings. In the regular church services, his mother had been one of the women who would occasionally stand up and start babbling out of her head in an unknown tongue. Eventually, as she became more and more filled with the Spirit, his father became less so and stopped going to church altogether. He told his children, "I believe in God, but I don't think you have to go crazy to prove it." Then, one spring when Smokey was 8, things got worse. His mother said that the Lord had told her that her husband was evil and devil-possessed, and she turned him in to the revenue agents. Smokey remembered the day they brought his daddy down the path from the still with a gun at his back. As he passed by his wife, he looked at her dumbfounded and said, "Woman, don't you know what you've done? You've done took the bread right out of your own mouth." It was the last Smokey ever saw of him. After his father left, his mother really went off the deep end and got mixed up with a bunch of backwoods holy roller snake handlers. One night, after an hour of ranting and beating the Bible, the red-faced, wild-haired preacher got his barefoot congregation all excited. They were all chanting and stomping their feet when suddenly he reached into a potato sack and pulled out 2 huge rattlesnakes and started waving them around in the air, lost in the Spirit. Smokey froze in his seat and squeezed his sister's hand. The preacher was dancing around, calling out for believers to take up the serpent and cleanse their souls in the faith of Abraham, when his mother ran up, grabbed one of the snakes away from him, and looked it right in the face. She began babbling in the unknown tongue, the whole time staring into the snake's yellow eyes. Everybody in the room began to sway and moan. As she started to walk around the room with it, people began falling down on the floor, jerking and screaming and rolling around under the pews and up and down the aisles. The place was in a frenzy while she babbled on, "Hosa, Halamna, Hesamia." Before he knew what was happening, his little sister Bernice broke away from him and ran up to her mother and pulled her by the hem of her dress. "Mama, don't!" Still wild-eyed and in a trance, she glanced down at her child for one split second. And in that second, the rattler lunged and struck the woman in the side of her face. She looked back at the snake, stunned, and he struck again, fast and hard this time, striking her in the neck, the fangs puncturing her jugular vein. She dropped the angry serpent with a thud, and it crawled contemptuously away down the aisle. His mother looked around the room that was now as silent as death, with a surprised look on her face, and as her eyes glazed over, she sank slowly to the floor. She was dead in less than a minute. In that moment, his uncle had picked up Smokey and was headed out the door. Bernice went to live with a neighbor, and Smokey stayed at his uncle's house. Then, when he was 13, he headed down the railroad tracks toward nowhere and never came back. The only thing he took was a photograph of his sister and him. He would take it out every once in a while. There they were in the fading photograph, with their lips and cheeks painted pink, a little chubby girl with bangs and a pink ribbon tied around her head, wearing a tiny string of pearls, and he sat just behind her, his brown hair slicked down, his cheek pressed close to hers. He often wondered how Bernice was doing, and thought he'd look her up one of these days, if he ever got back on his feet. When he was about 20 or so, he lost the picture when some railroad bull detective kicked him off a freight into a cold yellow river somewhere in Georgia, and now he hardly ever thought about her, except when he happened to be on a train passing through the Smoky Mountains at night on his way to somewhere else. This morning, Smokey Phillips was on a mixed train from Georgia headed for Florida. He had not eaten anything for 2 days and remembered that his friend Elmo Williams had told him that there were 2 women running a place right outside of Birmingham who were always good for a meal or two. On the way down, he'd seen the name of the cafe written on the walls of several boxcars. So when he saw the sign, Whistle Stop Alabama, he jumped off. He found the place across the tracks, just like Elmo had said. It was a small green building with a green and white awning under a Coca-Cola sign that said the Whistle Stop Cafe. He went around the back and knocked on the screen door. A little black woman was busy frying chicken and slicing green tomatoes. She glanced at him and called out, "Miss Iggy!" Pretty soon, a good-looking tall blonde with freckles and curly hair came to the door, wearing a clean white shirt and men's trousers. She looked to be in her early 20s. He took off his hat.
"Excuse me, ma'am. I was wondering if you had an odd job or something I might do. I've had a run of bad luck lately."
Iggy looked at the man in the worn-out dirty jacket, frayed brown shirt and cracked leather laceless shoes, and knew he wasn't lying. She opened the door and said, "Come on in, fella. I think we can find something for you." Iggy asked what his name was.
"Smokey, ma'am."
She turned to the woman behind the counter. Smokey hadn't seen a neat and clean woman in months, and this one was the prettiest woman he had seen in his entire life. She was wearing a dotted Swiss organdy dress and had her auburn hair pulled back with a red ribbon. "Ruth, this is Smokey, and he's going to be doing some work for us." Ruth looked at him and smiled. "That will be fine. Nice to meet you." Iggy pointed to the men's room. "Why don't you go in there and freshen up, and then come have a bite to eat?"
"Yes, ma'am."
The bathroom was big and had a light bulb hanging down from the ceiling, and when he pulled it, he saw that there was a big stand-up clawfoot tub over in the corner with a black rubber stopper on a chain. On the sink, already laid out, was a razor and a dish of shaving soap with a brush. As he looked at himself in the mirror, he felt ashamed that they had seen him so dirty. But he had not had more than a speaking acquaintance with soap for quite a while now. He took the big bar of brown Oxydol soap and tried to scrub all the grime and coal dust off his face and hands. He had not had a drink in 24 hours, and his hands shook so bad he was not able to get a clean shave, but he did the best he could. After he had splashed himself with the Old Spice shaving lotion and combed his hair with the Ace comb he had found on the shelf above the sink, he came back out into the cafe. Iggy and Ruth had set a place for him at a table. He sat down to a plate of fried chicken, black-eyed peas, turnip greens, fried green tomatoes, cornbread, and iced tea. He picked up his fork and tried to eat. His hands were still shaking, and he was not able to get the food to his mouth. He spilled his tea all over his shirt. He had been hoping they were not watching, but in a minute the blonde woman said, "Smokey, come on, let's take a walk outside." He got his hat and used his napkin, thinking he was being thrown out.
"Yes'm."
She walked him out behind the cafe where there was a field. "You're a pretty nervous fella, aren't you?"
"I'm sorry about spilling my food in there, ma'am. But to tell you the honest-to-God truth, well, I'll just head on. But thank you anyway."
Iggy reached in her apron pocket and pulled out a half-pint bottle of Old Joe whiskey and handed it to him. He was a mighty appreciative man. He said,
"God bless you for a saint, ma'am."
And they sat down on a log out by the shed. While Smokey was calming his nerves, she talked to him. "See that big plot of empty land over there?" He looked over.
"Yes'm."
"Years ago, that used to be the most beautiful little lake in Whistle Stop. In the summer, we'd swim in it and fish, and you could go for a boat ride if you wanted to." She shook her head sadly. "I sure do miss it. I sure do." Smokey looked at the vacant land.
"What happened to it?
Did it dry up? She lit a cigarette for him. No, it was worse than that. One November, a big flock of ducks, oh, about 40 or more, landed right smack in the middle of that lake. And while they were sitting there that afternoon, a fluke thing happened. The temperature dropped so fast that the whole lake froze over, as solid as a rock, in a matter of 3 seconds. 1, 2, 3, just like that. Smokey was amazed at the thought.
You don't mean it.
Yep.
Well, I reckon it must have killed them ducks.
Iggy said, Why, hell no. They just flew off and took the lake with them. That lake's somewhere in Georgia to this very day. He turned and looked at her, and when he realized she was pulling his leg, his blue eyes crinkled up and he started laughing so hard that he started to cough at the same time, and she had to bang him on the back. He was still wiping his eyes when they went back in the cafe where his dinner was waiting. When he sat back down to eat, it was warm. Someone had kept it in the oven for him. Oh, where is my wandering boy tonight, the boy of his mother's pride? Oh, he's counting the ties with a bed on his back, or else he's dinging a ride. Oh, where is my boy tonight? The Weems Weekly, Whistle Stop Alabama's Weekly Bulletin, October 22, 1929. Meteorite to be on display at cafe. Mrs. Biddy Louise Otis announced today that she was going to take the meteorite that came through her roof last week down to the cafe so people would stop calling her up about it because she is busy moving. She said that it is nothing but a big gray rock, but if anyone wants to look at it, they can. Iggy says to come on in the cafe whenever you want to, and she will have it on the counter. Sorry I don't have more news this week, but my other half, Wilbur, has the flu, and I've had to wait on him hand and foot all week. Is there anything worse than a man that's sick? We are sorry to report that our beloved 98-year-old Bessie Vick, Bertha's mother-in-law, died yesterday of what was thought to be old age. Dot Weems. Rose Terrace Nursing Home, Old Montgomery Highway, Birmingham, Alabama, December 22, 1985. The next Sunday, when Evelyn came to the visitors' lounge, Mrs. Threadgood was sitting in the same chair, wearing the same dress, waiting for her. Happy as a lark, she continued the conversation about the Threadgood house as if they had never been apart. And there was nothing Evelyn could do about it but unwrap her Almond Joy candy bar and sit there for the duration. The front yard had a great big old chinaberry tree. I remember we'd pick those little chinaberries all year long, and at Christmas we'd string them and wrap them all around the tree from top to bottom. Mama was always warning us not to put chinaberries up our nose, and of course the first thing Iggy did as soon as she learned to walk was to go out in the yard and put chinaberries up her nose and in her ears as well, to the point that Dr. Hadley had to be called. He told Mama, "Mrs. Threadgood, it looks like you've got yourself a little scallywag on your hands." Well, of course, Buddy just loved to hear that. He encouraged her every step of the way. But that's how it is in big families. Everybody has their favorite. Her real name was Imogene, but Buddy started calling her Iggy. Buddy was 8 when she was born, and he used to carry her all over town, just like she was a doll. When she got old enough to walk, she'd paddle around after him like a little duck, dragging that little wooden rooster behind her. That Buddy had a million-dollar personality, with those dark eyes and those white teeth. He could charm you within an inch of your life. I don't know of a girl in Whistle Stop that wasn't in love with him at some time or another. They say you never forget your sweet 16 party, and that's true. I still can remember that pink and white cake with the carousel on top, and that pale lime green punch Mama had in her crystal punch bowl, and those paper lanterns hanging all around the yard. But what stands out the most in my mind was Buddy Threadgood stealing a kiss from me over behind the grape arbor. Oh, he did. But I was just one of the many. Iggy was kept busy delivering love notes to and from Buddy night and day. We even started calling her Cupid. Iggy was a towhead, had short, curly blonde hair, blue eyes, and freckles. She took after Mama's side of the family. Mama's maiden name had been Alice Lee Cloud. She'd always say, "I was a cloud before I married." She was the sweetest thing. Almost everybody in the family had blue eyes, except Buddy, and poor Essie Rue, who had one brown eye and one blue one. Mama told her that was the reason she had so much musical talent. She saw the good in everything. One time, when Iggy and Buddy stole four big watermelons from Old Man Sockwell, they hid them in her blackberry patch. And, honey, the next morning, before they could get out there and get them, Mama found them and was convinced they had grown overnight. Cleo said there wasn't a year that went by she wasn't disappointed they didn't grow back. Nobody had the heart to tell her those melons had been stolen goods. Mama was a Baptist and Papa was a Methodist. He said he had an aversion to being dipped underwater. So every Sunday, Papa would go off to the left to the First Methodist Church, and the rest of us would go off to the right to the Baptist Church. Every once in a while, Buddy would go with Papa, but he stopped after a while. Said Baptist girls were prettier. Everybody was always staying at the Threadgood house. One summer, Mama had this big, fat Baptist preacher who was in town for a camp meeting, staying with us. And when he was out somewhere, the twins went into his room and got to playing in a pair of his trousers. Patsy Ruth got in one leg and Mildred got in the other. They were having a fine time until they heard him coming up the stairs. They got so scared that Mildred took off in one direction and Patsy Ruth took off in the other. Split those pants right in two. Mama said the only reason Papa didn't give them a spanking is because that preacher was a Baptist. But it never caused a serious rift, because after church we'd all meet back home for our Sunday dinner. Papa Threadgood wasn't rich, but it seemed to us at the time he was. He owned the only store in town. You could get anything you needed in there. You could buy a national washboard or shoestrings or get yourself a corset or a dill pickle right out of the barrel. Buddy used to work in the drugstore part, and I'd give all the tea in China for a strawberry ice cream soda like Buddy used to make. Everybody in Whistlestop traded there. That's why we were so surprised when the store closed down in 22. Cleo said the reason the store failed was because Papa couldn't say no to anybody, white or colored. Whatever people wanted or needed, he just put in a sack and let them have it on credit. Cleo said Papa's fortune had walked right out the door on him in paper bags. But then none of the Threadgoods could ever say no to anybody. Honey, they would give you the shirt off their backs if you asked for it. And Cleo was no better. Cleo and I never did have a lot of fancy things, but the good Lord provided, and we had everything we ever needed. I believe poor people are good people, except the ones that are mean. And they'd be mean even if they were rich. Most of the people who are living out here at Rose Terrace are poor, just have their Social Security, and most of them are on Medicaid. She turned to Evelyn. Honey, that's one thing you be sure and you get on right away is your Medicaid. You don't want to be caught without that. There's a few rich women out here. A couple of weeks ago, Mrs. Vesta Adcock, this little bird-breasted woman I know who's from Whistlestop, came in wearing her fox furs and her diamond dinner rings. She's one of the rich ones. But the rich ones don't seem happy to me. And I'll tell you something else. Their children don't come to see them any more often than the rest. Norris and Francis, Mrs. Otis's son and daughter-in-law, come to see her every week, rain or shine. That's why I come back here in the lounge on Sundays, to give them a little privacy so they can visit. But, oh, it would just break your heart to see some of them waiting for their visitors. They get their hair all done up on Saturday, and on Sunday morning they get themselves all dressed and ready. And after all that, nobody comes to see them. I feel so bad. But what can you do? Having children is no guarantee that you'll get visitors. No, it isn't. The Weems Weekly, Whistle Stop, Alabama's Weekly Bulletin, July 12, 1930. Whistle Stop Growing by Leaps and Bounds. Opal Threadgood, Julian's wife, has rented the building two doors down from me at the post office and is opening up a beauty shop of her own. She had been fixing people's hair in her kitchen, but Julian said for her to stop doing that because so many women were coming in and out the back door all day that it was causing their hens not to lay. Opal said the prices would still be the same, shampoo and set for 50 cents, and a permanent for $1.50. I, for one, am delighted at the new addition to our busy street. Just think, now you can mail a letter, have a meal, and get your hair done all on the same block. All we need now is a picture show to open up. Then none of us would ever need to go over to Birmingham again. Mr. and Mrs. Roy Glass had the Glass family annual reunion in their backyard, and all the Glasses came from all over the state to be there. And Wilma said the cake tasted better than it looked. By the way, my other half hooked his own finger the other day when he was fishing, so I've had him at home again, moaning and groaning. Dot Weems. Whistle Stop Cafe, Whistle Stop, Alabama, November 18, 1931. By now, the name of the cafe was written on the walls of hundreds of boxcars from Seattle to Florida. Splinter Belly Jones said he had seen it as far away as Canada. Things were especially bad that year, and at night the woods all around Whistle Stop twinkled from the fires at the hobo camps, and there wasn't a single man there that Iggy and Ruth had not fed at one time or another. Cleo, Iggy's brother, was concerned about it. He had come over to the cafe to pick up his wife, Ninny, and their little boy, Albert. He was having a cup of coffee and eating peanuts. "Iggy, I'm telling you, you don't need to feed everybody that shows up at your door. You've got a business to run here. Julian told me that he came by here the other day, and there were seven of them here eating. He says he thinks you'd let Ruth and the baby go without to feed those bums." Iggy dismissed the thought. "Oh, Cleo, what does Julian know? He'd starve to death himself if Opal didn't have the beauty shop. What are you listening to him for? He doesn't have the sense God gave a billy goat." Cleo couldn't disagree with her on that point. "Well, it's not only Julian, honey. I worry about you." "I know." "Well, I just want you to be smart and not be a fool and give away all your profits." Iggy looked at him and smiled. "Now, Cleo, I know for a fact that half the people in this town have not paid you for 5 years. I don't see you throwing them out the door." Ninny, who was usually quiet, piped up, "That's right, Cleo." Cleo ate a peanut. Iggy got up and grabbed him around the neck, playing with him. "Listen, you old bone cracker. You've never turned a hungry man away from your door in your life."
"I never had to. They were all over here," he said, and cleared his throat. "Now seriously, Iggy, I'm not trying to run your business or anything, but I just want to know if you're saving any money, that's all."
"What for?" Iggy said. "Listen, money will kill you, you know that. Why, just today a man came here and told me about his uncle, who had a good-paying job working up in Kentucky at the National Mint, making money for the government. And everything was going fine, until one day he pulled the wrong lever and was crushed to death by 700 pounds of dimes."
Ninny was horrified.
"Oh, no, how awful."
Cleo looked at his wife like she was crazy. "Good Lord, woman, I think you'd believe anything this nutty sister of mine told you."
"Well, it could have happened, couldn't it? Was he really killed by dimes, Iggy?"
"Sure was. It was either dimes or 300 pounds of quarters, I forget which. But in any case, he was killed all right."
Cleo shook his head at Iggy and had to laugh.
Rose Terrace Nursing Home, Old Montgomery Highway, Birmingham, Alabama, January 29, 1986. Every Sunday on visiting day, Ed Couch and his mother, Big Mama, would just sit in her cramped little room all afternoon and look at television. Today, Evelyn thought if she didn't get out of there soon, she would scream. She excused herself and said she was going to the bathroom down the hall. She had really planned to go sit in the car, but had forgotten that Ed had the car keys. So there she was, back again in the lounge with Mrs. Threadgood, unwrapping a package of coconut snowballs from the hostess company, while Mrs. Threadgood was telling her about last night's dinner at Rose Terrace.
"So there she was, honey, sitting at the head of the table, all puffed up and bragging."
"Who?"
"Mrs. Adcock."
"Mrs. Adcock?"
"Mrs. Adcock. You remember Mrs. Adcock with the fox furs? Mrs. Adcock."
Evelyn thought for a minute. "Oh, the rich one."
"That's right, Mrs. Adcock, with the dinner rings."
"That's right."
Evelyn handed her the open package.
"Oh, thank you. I love a snowball."
She took a bite, and after a while she said, "Evelyn, don't you want a Coca-Cola to wash it down with? I've got some change in my room, and I'll get you a cold drink if you want one. They've got a machine down the hall."
Evelyn said, "No, Mrs. Threadgood, I'm all right, but would you like one?"
"Oh, no, honey. Normally I would, but today I've got a kind of gassy-like feeling, so I'd just as soon have some water, if you don't mind."
Evelyn went outside the door and got them both little white cone cups of cold water.
"Thank you kindly."
"What about Mrs. Adcock?"
Mrs. Threadgood looked at her.
"Mrs. Adcock? Do you know her?"
"No, I don't know her. You were just saying that she was bragging about something."
"Oh, that's right, I was. Well, Mrs. Adcock was telling us at the dinner table last night that everything in her house is a genuine antique, over 50 years old. Said everything she owned was worth a lot of money. I told Mrs. Otis, 'Here, I started out in life not worth much of anything, and I've turned out to be a priceless antique, probably worth a fortune on the market.'"
She laughed, tickled at the idea, and then thought for a moment.
"I wonder whatever happened to all those little china doll dishes in that little goat cart we used to play with. On Saturdays, we'd go for a ride in this goat cart that Papa had made for us girls, and we thought it was better than a trip to Paris. I wouldn't be surprised if that old goat was still alive.
His name was Harry. Harry the goat. He'd eat anything. She laughed. One time, Itchy fed him a whole jar of Leona's Mum underarm deodorant, and he lapped it up just like it was ice cream. We played all kinds of games, but nobody loved to play dress-up any more than the thread goods. One year, Mama dressed us four girls up as the four different suits in a pack of cards for the contest they were having over at the church. I was the clubs, the twins were hearts and diamonds, and Essie Rue was spades. And here comes Iggy tagging along after us as the joker in the pack. We took first prize. I remember one 4th of July, all of us girls had on our stars and stripes dresses with our paper crowns. We were all out in the backyard having our dish of homemade ice cream, waiting for the fireworks to start. When here comes Buddy Threadgood down the back stairs, all dressed up in one of Leona's midi dresses, with a big bow tie on his head, and he commenced to prissing and mincing. He was imitating Leona, don't you see? Then, to make matters worse, Edward or Julian or one of the boys had carried the Victrola out in the yard and was winding away on it, playing the Sheik of Araby, while Buddy hoochie-coochied all around the yard. We've laughed over that for years. Later, Buddy gave Leona a big kiss. You could forgive Buddy anything. After it got dark, Papa would hire these fireworks people to come and put on a show for the whole town, and all the colored people from Troutville would come. What a sight! Those fireworks would explode and light up the whole sky. And, of course, all the boys would go crazy popping their firecrackers. Then, after it was all over, we'd go back in and sit in the parlor and listen to Essie Rue pound away on the piano. She'd play Listen to the Mockingbird, Nola, or whatever song was popular that year, while Iggy sat in the tree and howled at her. Seems like Iggy was always in overalls and barefooted. It's a good thing, too. She would have ruined any nice dresses going up and down trees like she did. And she was always going hunting or fishing with Buddy and her brothers. Buddy said that she could shoot as good as any of the boys. She was a pretty little thing, except after Buddy got her hair all bobbed off, you'd swear she was a little boy. But all the Threadgood girls were pretty. Oh, not that they didn't work at it. Especially Leona. She was the vainest one of the girls, and she didn't have a sense of humor about it either. Of course, my looks were always just passing, because I was so tall. I used to want to hunch over a little because of it, but Mama Threadgood used to say, "Ninny, the good Lord made you tall so you would be closer to heaven." But I'm not as tall now as I used to be. When you get old, you shrink. Isn't hair a funny thing? So many people are just crazy about their hair. Of course, I guess it's just natural. The mention of hair runs all through the Bible. Samson and that Sheba woman and that girl that washed Jesus' feet with her hair. Isn't it odd the colored want straight hair, and we're always wanting curly hair? I had brown hair at one time, but now I use silk and silver number 15. I used to use number 16, but it made my hair too dark, and it looked kind of dyed-looking. Back then, I just twisted it up in a knot and went on about my business. Not Miss Leona. Her hair was always a sore spot between her and Iggy. I guess Iggy was around 9 or 10, and she'd been over in Troutville playing with the children there and came home with a case of head lice. So we all had to wash our hair with this mixture of sulfur, kerosene, and lard. I never heard so much screaming and hollering. You would have thought that Leona was being burned at the stake. Leona wouldn't speak to poor Iggy after that. During that time, Buddy came home from school and saw that Iggy was pretty low. He had a football game to go to, and when he was leaving the house that night, he said, "Come on, little bit," and he took her down to the football game and let her sit right on the bench with the rest of the players. That was Buddy for you. I don't think Leona ever really forgave Iggy until after she married.